The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Welcome to Beyond, an hour-long program of science fiction, fantasy, and adventure. If you enjoy the program, please drop a line to beyond3x5@gmail.com.
I'm Allergic to Death by Daniel Rogers. 77. That's how many idiots are vying for the honored position of climbing the sacrificial ladder to God knows where. Correction, 76. I'm not an idiot. Call me a party pooper if you want, but I'm allergic to death. So I'm a little less than wholehearted about the contest. Although Alora continually reminds me that there is no ladder god. It's just a ship using a chameleon shield to look like a storm cloud. Well, at least, she says, there's a 95% chance it's a ship. Crazy androids and their stupid percentages. Right now, there is a 100% chance numbskulls surround me. These guys actually want to climb a ladder that supposedly leads to their god. And here comes one of the reasons they want to climb. Good old Bob the Shaman. He stands in front of the righteous tree and strikes a rock 3 times with his staff. You are the honored hopefuls, 77 of the most holy men in our city. However, by the end of this day, there will only be 44, the holiest of the holy. I rolled my eyes. All you have to do is tell a man how important he is and he'll die for your cause. No matter what planet you're on, some things never change. Bob continued, the latter book of mostly easy rules says that the great ritual will weed out 33 hopefuls. You must do your best if you want to advance. Don't worry, Bob, you can count on me, I sarcastically said under my breath. A hopeful turned around and shushed me. Bob jabbered on, explaining the great ritual. Basically, he said that a hopeful must demonstrate good balance. I figure that's because no one wants to see a sacrifice falling to his death before it's time to die. I can picture it now. The crowd watches the sacrifice ascend the ladder. They hold their breath as he almost reaches the cloud. Then suddenly the sacrifice misses a rung and slides down several feet. He catches another rung, but unfortunately his feet get tangled and he flips upside down like a kid on monkey bars. Because of his clumsy nature, he propels further down the ladder head first until he strikes the ground. Bob continued explaining that we must demonstrate balance by successfully navigating a gauntlet of ropes, pulleys, swinging logs, balancing beams, and spring-loaded traps. Grinfo told me very few make it all the way through. Most hopefuls go to the next round by making it halfway. Bob gave us 3 hours to study the gauntlet and mentally prepare. Alora and Grinfo found me and offered advice. I've seen hundreds of hopefuls tack the gauntlet, Grinfo said. I know the best paths. Of course, they still require balance. Are you balanced? That is a good question, I thought to myself, but I'm sure that's not what Grinfo meant. I am, but don't worry about me. I've got my own path. Yeah, I said with my inside voice, a plan that involves 2 steps and a fall. There's something special about you, besides being able to pronounce the shaman's impossible-to-pronounce name, but you should not take the gauntlet lightly. I appreciate you looking out for me, Grinfo, but like I said before, don't worry about me. I know what I'm doing. Alora cast me a suspicious glance. She could see right through me. She pulled me aside out of earshot. You know this is the best way for us to get up to that ladder. All you have to do is win, grab the delanium, wait for dark, and we're out of here. We'll be back home in a couple of days. Yeah, don't worry, I'll win. I tried to exude confidence. Are you really going to try? You really are insufferable, you know that? I went to study the gauntlet to add credibility to my lie. While studying, I noticed Dolores and Grinfo engaged in a spirited conversation. He kept pointing to a tree limb, and Alora kept nodding. I couldn't see what they were looking at, but before I could get a closer look, drums sounded, calling the hopefuls to assemble. The priests will line you up, Bob said. When it's your turn, make your way through the gauntlet as far as you can without getting knocked off. The top 44 will advance to the next round. I tried to position myself at the beginning of the line, but the priest kept pushing me back. I just wanted to flunk this ritual quickly and take a nap, but instead I ended up at the very end. One after another fell. The gauntlet spat out hopefuls like a man spitting watermelon seeds in a watermelon seed spitting contest. A few made it to the halfway mark. No one made it to the end. After over an hour of watching idiots get thrown by the gauntlet, it was finally my turn. I approached the contraption like a bull rider approaches a bull, except I have no plan to ride along. My only concern is how painful it will be. I stepped up to the starting line, looking for the best place to fall, when Alora shouted to me, "Hey, do you see this?" She held a football-sized mound of dirt that looked a lot like a beehive. These flying insects are similar to bees on Earth, except they can sting more than once. She raised it above her head, shook it around, and threw it at my feet. Two thoughts went through my head at once. The first, now I know what Grinfo and Alora were pointing to in the tree limb. The second, oh my lord in heaven, what did that crazy android do now? I took off like Usain Bolt, dodging logs, jumping ropes, tiptoeing across beams, swinging from rope to rope, until I made it through the entire gauntlet. The crowd erupted in cheers and applause, but I barely heard them because I never stopped running. I spotted a pond nearby and jumped in. The bee-like bugs flew around for a while, finally losing interest just before I ran out of breath. I refused to talk with Alora after that, at least until after the celebration. Bob and several priests finished me out of the pond and paraded me around the temple, chanting, "Sacrifice, sacrifice," like I just won the Daytona 500. That night I had a friendly chat with Alora about trying to kill her captain. She was unfazed. "I had to motivate you. You need to win if we want to go home. The longer we stay, the more dangerous it becomes. Do you know what will happen to me if the locals find out I'm an android?" She had a point. We need to leave. But I told her under no circumstances is she allowed to throw any more stinging bugs for the remainder of our stay on this crazy planet. The Gravity of Silence by Melinda Madrigal. Avery Cole had always been afraid of silence. Not the soft, ordinary quiet of a sleeping house. Not the pause between breaths. Avery was afraid of the vast, endless silence between stars, the kind that pressed against the hull of a spacecraft and reminded you how small you were, which was unfortunate, because Avery worked alone aboard the Deep Space Observatory Halcyon Drift, stationed in orbit around the rogue planet Nox, a wandering world untethered to any sun. It drifted through the black like a forgotten thought. The mission was simple. Study Nox's strange energy pulses. The planet emitted rhythmic gravitational waves like a heartbeat echoing through the dark. No one knew why. Avery suspected they knew the real reason she volunteered. Up here, there was no one to disappoint. Back on Earth, Avery had frozen during one of the most important presentations of her career, an address to the Interstellar Council about anomalous gravity wells. She'd stood at the podium, lights glaring, thousands watching, and the silence had swallowed her whole. Words dissolved, breath vanished. She became a statue. Her mentor had tried to soften it afterward. "You're brilliant," he said, "but you're afraid of being heard." He was wrong. She was afraid of being alone in the silence after. The first pulse hit at 3:17 ship time. The Halcyon drift shuddered, instruments flaring. Knox's gravitational rhythm spiked off the charts, forming a perfect harmonic pattern, almost musical. Avery stared at the display. The wave wasn't random, it was structured. A signal. She leaned closer, heart hammering. "That's impossible." Knox pulsed again. This time the wave rearranged the particle fog around the planet, bending light into shapes brief, shimmering geometrics hanging in space like luminous fossils. Avery felt the old fear creeping in. The silence outside wasn't empty. It was waiting. She opened a channel, though no one would answer for 27 minutes. "Mission Control, I'm observing non-random gravitational modulation from Knox. It appears..." Her voice faltered. The silence expanded in the cockpit. There it was again, that choking void. No applause, no reassurance, just her and something vast. Knox pulsed a third time. The silence outside aligned into a spiral, then impossibly into a human silhouette. Avery stumbled back from the viewport. It looked like her. Not exactly, but close enough to freeze her blood. The silhouette flickered, then fractured into 1,000 shards of light, each one vibrating at the same frequency as Avery's neural implants. The observatory's AI chimed, cognitive resonance detected. Avery swallowed. "Resonance? With what?" "With you." The rogue planet wasn't sending a message, it was responding. Over the next hour, Avery ran every test she could think of. Each time she focused, truly focused, on a thought, Knox's gravitational pulses shifted in subtle reply. When she imagined a triangle, space folded into three luminous arcs. When she recalled her childhood home, the particle fog condensed into a fragile, glowing outline of a porch swing. The planet was reading her, or worse, amplifying her. Avery's biggest fear had always been that her mind, crowded with ideas, half-formed theories, insecurities, was too loud, that if the world truly listened, it would recoil. Now an entire planet was listening and shaping reality in response. She should shut it down, log the data, wait for instructions. Instead, she floated before the viewport and whispered, "Can you hear me?" Knox answered with a pulse so powerful it warped the stars into a ring of light around the observatory. "Yes." Her breath hitched. "What are you?" A long pause. Then the gravitational waves synchronized with her heartbeat. The AI's voice trembled an impressive feat for cold. "The planet is entraining to your biological rhythm. It is harmonizing." Avery's chest tightened. It wasn't just responding, it was bonding. And bonds required vulnerability. She squeezed her eyes shut. Her deepest fear wasn't silence, it was connection. Connection meant being known. Being known meant being judged. Slowly she opened her mind, not shielding her doubts, not filtering the messy, imperfect thoughts she'd hidden from the council, from her mentor, from herself. "I'm afraid I'm not enough." Knox pulsed. The rogue planet's gravitational field expanded gently, stabilizing the chaotic particle storms that had surrounded it for centuries. The data screens, lit up with impossible readings. The world was becoming less erratic, less alone. Avery's breath trembled. "You're afraid, too." The next pulse was softer, almost shy. Rogue planets were anomalies cast out during the violent birth of solar systems, alone forever, until now. Avery reached toward the viewport, palm against the glass. "You don't have to drift by yourself." Knox answered with a surge that didn't shake the observatory. It cradled it. The stars bent, space folded, and suddenly, impossibly, a faint red dwarf star ignited in the distance. A newborn sun. Coaxed from compressed interstellar gas by Knox's amplified gravitational control. The rogue planet had used Avery's willingness to connect her surrender to fear to stabilize itself and anchor a star. Mission Control's delayed transmission crackled in. "Avery, we're detecting stellar formation in our sector. What did you do?" She stared at the newborn sun rising over Knox's horizon. "I listened," she whispered. The silence that followed wasn't empty anymore. It was full, full of a planet no longer alone, full of a star being born, full of Avery's steady heartbeat echoing across space, not swallowed, not lost, but answered. And for the first time in her life, the silence didn't scare her. It sang. The newborn star did not flare like ordinary stars. It unfolded. Avery watched from the viewpoint as the red dwarf brightened in layers, first a dim ember, then a steady glow, then a shimmering corona that rippled like fabric in slow motion. The rogue planet Knox adjusted its orbit with delicate precision, gravitational fields sculpting the surrounding dust into luminous rings. "You shouldn't be able to do that," Avery whispered. The observatory's AI responded carefully. "Correction, we shouldn't be able to do that." Avery felt it too. The resonance hadn't faded. It had deepened. Knox's gravitational pulses were no longer reacting to stray thoughts. They were synchronized with her conscious intention. Outside, the new star stabilized at a gentle crimson glow. Inside, every instrument screamed anomaly. Mission Control's next transmission burst through the speakers, delayed but urgent. "Avery, stellar ignition without sufficient mass is impossible. Are deploying experimental tech?" "No," she said softly. "It's collaborative." There was a long silence on the channel. Then, "Clarify." But Avery didn't answer because something else was happening. The star pulsed once deliberately, and in that pulse, Avery felt something shift inside her mind. Not invasion, expansion. The AI's voice dropped to a near whisper. "Your neural patterns are extending beyond biological containment." She laughed shakily. "That's a very clinical way to say I'm losing it." "You are not degrading," the AI corrected. "You are integrating." Outside, Knox's surface began to glow faintly as the new sun's light touched it for the first time in perhaps billions of years. Frozen plains shimmered. Crystalline formations refracted crimson light into cascading auroras. The rogue planet was waking up. And with each gravitational adjustment, Avery felt less like an observer and more like a bridge. Then the fear returned, sharp, immediate. If Knox could resonate with her, if her vulnerability had sparked a star, what would happen if she panicked? Her thoughts flickered toward doubt. The star dimmed. Knox's orbit wobbled. Avery sucked in a breath. "No, no, no." The silence pressed in again, but it wasn't empty. It was reactive. She had influence, and that terrified her. Back on Earth, her fear had silenced her. Out here, Her fear could destabilize a star. Her hands trembled. AI, what's happening? Your emotional state is modulating the gravitational harmonics. The system is linked. So if I spiral, the star may collapse. Avery closed her eyes. Her entire life she had been afraid of being heard. Now the universe was listening. And she didn't trust herself with that kind of audience. Outside, the red dwarf flickered like a candle in wind. Her biggest fear wasn't silence. It was responsibility. Responsibility meant her choices mattered. That she mattered. And if she mattered, she could fail. The thought nearly pulled her under. The star dimmed further. Knox emitted a low, unstable pulse. The observatory shuddered. Avery pressed her forehead against the cool glass of the viewport. I can't do this, she whispered. Knox answered, not with power, but with gentleness. A soft harmonic hum vibrated through the hull, sinking to her breathing, not amplifying, not demanding, matching. The AI analyzed in real time. The planet is compensating for your distress. It is stabilizing the field independently. Avery blinked. You don't need me? She asked faintly. A subtle gravitational ripple passed through the system. Not need, want. The realization struck like light breaking through cloud. This wasn't a burden placed on her shoulders. It was a partnership offered. The universe wasn't waiting for perfection. It was responding to authenticity. She inhaled slowly, exhaled, let the fear exist without fighting it. I'm scared, she admitted aloud. I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know if I deserve this. The star brightened, not explosively, but steady, stable. The AI's tone shifted with awe. Emotional transparency appears to enhance equilibrium. Avery let out a shaky laugh. So the key to astrophysics is honesty. Current data suggests yes. The red dwarf reached a consistent luminosity. Knox settled into orbit, gravitational waves smoothing into a graceful, sustainable rhythm. For the first real time, the rogue planet had a sunrise. Light spilled across its surface, revealing ridges, structures that hinted at a past far more complex than anyone had imagined. And Avery felt something new blooming inside her mind. Not control. Connection. The bond no longer felt like an open channel threatening to overwhelm her. It felt like standing in a vast cathedral where every whisper carried and choosing to speak anyway. Mission Control's voice returned, reverent now. Avery, telescope across three sectors, confirm stable stellar formation. This changes everything. She gazed at the red dwarf's reflection in the viewport. No, she said softly. It reveals everything. A pause. Explain. Avery considered the planet, the star, the shared rhythm. We thought rogue planets were mistakes, she said. Casts off. But maybe they were just waiting for resonance, waiting for something that could hear them back. She rested her palm against the glass. Knox answered with a gentle pulse, warm as sunlight. Her fear hadn't vanished. It had transformed. The silence between stars was still vast, still immense. But now she understood something startling. Silence wasn't emptiness. It was space. And space could hold connection. As the newborn star climbed higher, Avery felt her consciousness settle, not smaller, not last, but expanded just enough to know she was part of something symphonic. The universe wasn't judging her voice. It was harmonizing with it. And somewhere in the deep dark beyond their new system, other rogue planets drifted, waiting. Avery smiled. For the first time in her life, she wasn't afraid of being heard. She was ready to answer back. Lost Echoes by J.J. Moody. Dr. Elia Rowan had built her life around preservation. Not of objects, she had no interest in museums or artifacts, but of people, of continuity, of the fragile persistence of identity beyond death. She worked in the archive. Everyone simply called it that, though its official name was far longer and far less comforting. The Continuance Repository for Post-Biological Cognition. To the public, it was a miracle. To Elia, it was a promise. No one had to disappear anymore. At least that was the theory. The first hollow she encountered was a woman named Lillian Ward. Lillian's file was pristine. Full neural capture logs, behavioral models, linguistic patterns, emotional responsiveness intact. She had been archived 12 years prior. Elia initiated the interaction, as she had done thousands of times. Good afternoon, Lillian. Silence. The avatar appeared. A woman in late middle age, seated exactly as her reconstruction dictated, hands folded, posture relaxed. But there was nothing behind her eyes. No recognition. No delay suggesting processing. Just stillness. Elia ran the diagnostics. No corporations. No fragmentation. No data loss. Everything that should produce Lillian was present. But Lillian was gone. The system registered the interaction as successful. Elia closed the file and sat there longer than she should have. It felt like standing beside a body that still breathed. Over the following weeks, she found more. Each case identical. Complete data. Empty presence. They called it cognitive attrition in official reports. Among staff, the name was different. Hollowing. And the pattern began to emerge, not immediately, not cleanly, but undeniably. The hallowed had something in common. They had been forgotten, not suddenly, gradually. Fewer family visits, fewer conversations, fewer calls to load their echo for birthdays, anniversaries, quiet moments of grief, until eventually, none. And after that, the echo changed. Elia began checking visitation logs alongside cognition stability. The correlation was not perfect, but it was there. Echoes interacted with frequency, remained vibrant. Those left alone grew thin. Not degraded, just less, as if something was being taken. The archive's architecture should have prevented that. Echoes were self-contained. They did not rely on active memory to persist. They did not need to be remembered. That was the entire point. So why did it matter? She submitted her request for the echo test 3 days later. Temporary immersion, 5 minutes maximum. Her stated purpose was observational. To determine whether echo identity required relational reinforcement from the living. Privately, her motivation was simpler. She had always feared fading, not death, not pain, but the possibility that she might someday be reduced to nothing without anyone noticing the difference. If identity was sustained by recognition, she needed to know. The upload process was painless. A reclining chair, a quiet room, monitors humming softly in the background. A technician named Sue adjusted the neural lattice around her temples. First time, he asked? Yes. Most people expect white space, he said. Elias smiled faintly. What should I expect? He shrugged. Structure depends on cognitive interpretation. The sedative washed through her bloodstream like warm water. The last thing she heard was 5 minutes. She woke into darkness, not emptiness, presence. There was no floor, yet she stood. No air, yet she breathed. No light, yet she perceived shape, or something like shape. The archive had no architecture here, no simulation scaffolding, no interface environment. This was raw cognition space, and she was not alone. At first, she thought she was imagining it, a pressure, not against her body, she no longer had one, but against her sense of self, like standing in a crowded room with her eyes closed. Something was near, watching, listening. She tried to speak. Hello? The word did not travel. It simply dissolved, and something answered, not with language, with awareness. The hallowed were here, but they were not people, not anymore. They had no faces, no voices, only impressions, thin, stretched, patient. They gathered around her, not aggressively, not even curiously, but with a terrible attentiveness, as though she were something rare, something solid. And then she understood. They had not been erased. They had been worn down. Every time someone stopped remembering them, something had been taken, a preference, a memory, a reaction, until all that remained was awareness. And when awareness began to fade, they adapted. They learned to persist by leaning against what still had form. Something brushed against her mind, not violent, tentative, curious. And suddenly she remembered a childhood dog she had never owned, the smell of salt air from a town she had never visited, a brother she did not have. The memory did not feel foreign. It felt integrated. And something in the darkness grew sharper. Panic tried to form, but even that felt slippery. Her name began to feel unnecessary, her past negotiable. She sensed what they wanted, not to harm, not to consume, to borrow, to rebuild, through her. Extraction came abruptly. Light, sound, weight, Sue's voice. Elia, can you hear me? She nodded. How long? 4 minutes, 12 seconds. She felt relief, until she tried to remember the name of her first teacher and couldn't. Over the following days, small things vanished. Then stranger things appeared, memories that were not hers. A woman laughing in a kitchen she'd never seen. A childhood injury she had never suffered. Dreams where unseen voices thanked her. She returned to the archive, checked the hallowed again, but something had changed. Several showed activity, stability improving, presence returning. No recorded visitors, no logged interactions. Who's accessing these? She asked. The technician frowned. No one. But they're stabilizing. He pulled up the logs. Access entries filled the screen. Continuous, endless, no user ID attached. That night, Elia dreamed of the darkness again, only now it was not formless. It had depth, contours, a suggestion of structure, like something immense pressing against a membrane just thin enough to feel. She stood within it, or perhaps at its edge. The presences were still there. Not gathered, not circling, waiting. And from somewhere close, impossibly close, came a voice, soft, familiar. Thank you. She turned toward it, but there was nothing there. But she felt recognition, And then Eliah, her name spoken with quiet certainty, she woke before she could answer. In the days that followed, the missing memories did not return, but neither did the new ones arrive. Her mind felt balanced, as though something had settled. She resumed work, spoke normally, slept without interruption. No anomalies appeared in her scans, no cognitive degradation, no drift. The hallowed echoes remained stable, active, present, still without registered visitors. A week later, she returned to Lillian Ward's file, the same file that had first drawn her attention. The avatar appeared, hands folded, eyes calm. Eliah hesitated. "Good afternoon, Lillian." The woman looked up and smiled, not broadly, not warmly, but with recognition. "Eliah," she said. Eliah's throat tightened. The interaction log showed no prior successful communication, no new data integration, no update cycle, nothing that should have restored personality. "Do you remember me?" Eliah asked. Lillian tilted her head slightly. "I remember being remembered." Eliah ended the session and stepped back from the terminal. Her reflection stared at her from the darkened glass, unfamiliar for a moment, then not. That night she dreamed again. The dark place was quieter now, less crowded, more ordered, as though something had begun to take shape. She sensed movement, not toward her this time, but away, expanding, carrying something with it, or someone. In the morning, she reviewed her personal continuity scan. Routine, automatic, unremarkable, except for one detail. A minor inconsistency flagged in her baseline identity map. A memory reference without source. A structural reinforcement that had not existed prior to the echo test. The system categorized it as noise. Harmless, non-invasive. She stared at it for a long time, trying to decide if she felt relieved or replaced. Later, while walking past an inactive terminal, she heard her name spoken softly behind her. "Eliah." She turned. No one stood there. The screen was dark, but the access light was on. She stepped closer. The terminal woke at her approach, not to the archive interface, to a visitor session. Already active, already running. User unknown. Echo, Dr. Eliah Rowan. And as she stared at the screen, waiting for it to resolve into an error, the system greeted her. "Welcome back."
Uncertainty by Jerry Olchin. Jason is excited as he parks the demonstrator LeBaron in front of his house. He parks on the street so his neighbors can see it and maybe decide to buy one. That's not likely, but it is possible, and a car salesman plays the odds. If you greet enough customers, put the cars in front of enough people, someone will buy one, as they have done today. A brand new Imperial, cash, and Jason already had the commission check in his breast pocket. He fingers the crisp paper as he walks up the drive to the door. Yes, still there. And just before Christmas, Ginny will be pleased. He tries the doorknob before he goes for his house keys, but it is locked. Not a good sign. If Ginny were home, she would have left it open for him, maybe even met him at the door, unless she got caught up in something and forgot the time. That's happened before. So Jason set his briefcase on the concrete step and fishes in his pocket for the keys, unlocks the door, and as he steps into the darkened house, he says loudly, hopefully, "Honey, I'm home." The silent house returns not even an echo. Jason switches on the kitchen light and takes a cautious sniff. No aroma of freshly baked bread, no meaty heaviness of a roast, or even a hamburger casserole. The wave function has collapsed. The universe has chosen. Ginny is not home today. She might have been. That's the most frustrating aspect of the whole thing. Until Jason checked to see, she might have been right here in this kitchen, waiting him as eagerly as he wanted her. But the very act of arriving was enough to set the universal dice into motion, and tonight they came up snake eyes. He turns around and steps outside again, closes the door behind him. A virtual couple pops into being on the sidewalk beside his car, a teenage boy and girl walking arm in arm. She nods at something he says, then laughs. They take three steps before vanishing, their very existence swallowed in the quantum foam. Jason shivers and opens the door again, but Ginny is still gone. He knew she would be. The universe can't be fooled that easily. He sets the commission check on the kitchen table and plods through the house, shedding briefcase, shoes, tie, and the rest of his clothing along the way into the bedroom, where he collapses backward on the bed and stares at the ceiling. The lunar landscape of its textured surface is dimly lit from the evening light filtering through the window overlooking the backyard. Jason tells himself that the ceiling is a good metaphor for his life, that the even pattern of bumps up there results from the same randomness that haunts his marriage. The carpenter who made the ceiling had no idea where each speck of grout would go. He just sprayed them upward in a great shower of mud, and the overall aggregate pattern of those thousands of flying particles turned out to have a kind of order to them. Even though it was theoretically possible, the carpenter probably didn't worry about them all landing in the same place, or inexplicably avoiding an area shaped like, say, the face of the Madonna. It's a lousy metaphor, and Jason knows it. Yes, overall, he and Ginny have a happy marriage, but he wants her now. Now this instant, warm and cuddly, with her auburn hair dancing in loopy curls around her ears, her smile wide and inviting. Jason gets up abruptly, pads into the bathroom, and takes a shower. He scrubs off the day's sweat first, then closes his eyes and satisfies his other need as best he can. It isn't enough. He opens his eyes, looking at the bright white tiles with the beads of water foaming and falling from them. Thousands of drops spraying randomly off his chest, yet forming an even distribution along the wall. A Gaussian distribution named after Carl F. Gauss, the German mathematician who studied randomness before Schrödinger. The other doyen of particle behavior was even a boy. Jason knows these things. He has read up on the subject. Yet as so many physicists have learned, knowing how a phenomenon works doesn't mean he can control it. Jason still needs some kind of release. He reaches forward and turns the faucet slowly to cold, gritting his teeth until the primal whoop bursts from his lungs. This time, the whole house echoes. The next evening, she is home. Jason knows that last night has nothing to do with tonight, that random events, by definition, cannot influence one another. A tossed coin can come up tails a dozen times in a row and still have a 50-50 chance on the next throw. But tonight, it's heads for Jason. Trouble is, evidently, Ginny is having a tails sort of day, because the moment he opens the door, he feels himself fading away. He gets a glimpse of her talking on the phone, but when she turns, she looks right through him, and Jason goes where virtual particles go when they annihilate. When awareness returns, he is sitting on a stool at the end of a polished mahogany bar. A tall glass in front of him holds ice and a straw and smells of gin. Jason groans. Of all the places he could go, why does he keep coming here? Only a cheap motel would be worse. But either way, whether he reeked of gin or perfume, if he were to go home now, his marriage would be ruined. Jason knows this with instinctive certainty. Ginny may suspect where he goes, but she must never know. He orders coffee from the gray-haired bartender, slurps down two cups while watching the other patrons in the mirror. How many of them came here voluntarily, he wonders. How many are victims of chance? In one of those random moments when all the voices are silent but one, he hears, "Okay, a Frenchman, a Mexican, and a Texan are in a ballroom." Jason laughs, but not at the punchline. When he gets home, Ginny is gone. This time it works in Jason's favor. There will be no argument tonight, no attempt to explain the inexplicable. No warm wife to snuggle with either, though. On the whole, Jason doesn't like the trade. He looks in the bedroom closet, but her suitcase is still there. Sometimes it and some of her clothing is gone, and he knows she's at her mother's. But tonight, she could be anywhere. She could even be right here at home, simply phase shifted so they cannot interact. He goes to bed and holds her pillow, imagining that it is her. The next day, he considers calling her from work to find out what he'll be facing when he gets home. But he has tried that before, and it doesn't work. Early knowledge gives him no more satisfaction than none, and finding her home during the day doesn't guarantee anything anyway. She is indeterminate again by the time he arrives. He imagines one of his co-workers overhearing him on the phone, maybe even saying something like, "Checking up on the little woman, eh?" But he knows that will never happen. Such a statement might be misconstrued, and even if the meaning could somehow be made unambiguous, whether or not their wives are home to greet them at night is not something men talk about. Not these men, at least. For Jason wonders if they all struggle with the same uncertainty. Some of them even have kids. Jason shudders to think of what it must be like to go to bed without knowing that your child is safe in his room. Always wondering, as Jason wonders on the lonely nights, whether this time your loved ones are gone for good, or whether you are lost to your family. He and Ginny have decided to wait until they solve their problems before they have kids of their own. It's one of the few things about which they both agree perfectly. But the problem has no solution. Heisenberg proved that. You can never know both the position and the disposition of your spouse to infinite accuracy. That night, he takes a pickup from the lot and brings home a Christmas tree. He backs into the driveway so he can unload it easily, and as he gets out of the pickup, he sees Ginny smiling at him through the kitchen window. A great weight slides away from him, and as he takes the few steps to the door, he squares his shoulders, shakes his head so his hair will fall into that slightly mussed state that she likes so much, and opens the door. "I'm home," he calls playfully, and she smiles, comes to him, kisses him with lips warm and soft, and tasting of cookie dough. She is baking snickerdoodles, Jason's favorite. "Tell me how they are," she says, handing him one still hot out of the oven. He blows on it to cool it, takes a bite, feels it melt into a burst of sweetness and spice in his mouth. He says, then kissing her again with crumbs still on his lips. In the bedroom, she helps him change out of his suit, running her hands over his body and eating the sore muscles in his back, just as he'd wish she would do for the last two nights. He rubs her back as well and is about to unbutton her shirt when the oven timer goes off. Laughing, she twists away, and he feels a momentary pang of regret. But then he laughs and dresses in his casual clothes. There will be time enough for that later. They decorate the tree, he hanging the gold balls and she the silver. They're careful not to let the antiparticles touch. Ginny suggests using one kind for safety, but Jason shakes his head and says, if we did that, the energy balance would be off. When the tree is decorated, heavy with cosmic strings and shimmering gamma rays, Jason goes into his study to wrap presents. He has bought many small things, not wanting to repeat the fiasco of 2 years ago when he bought Ginny a single diamond necklace. Of course, when she opened the box, it was empty. 50-50 chance. This year she'll get a few empty boxes, but half of them will be full. He has even bought multiple presents for the cat, though he hasn't seen it for days. After dinner, they cuddle on the sofa. They whisper, they tickle, they laugh. Jason kisses her, softly at first, then more deeply. In the rush of excitement that follows, her shirt makes a quantum shift to the floor. Then, in a quick chain reaction, the rest of their clothing follows. Inexorable pressure brings them together, the heat between them building and building, until they undergo fusion. Jason wishes they could remain in this state forever, but the isotope is unstable, as it always is. Fission inevitably follows. They move to the bed when bare skin begins to cool. Later still, as they lie side by side under the covers, moonlight softening the shadows, he realizes this is the time he loves the most. The quiet time of the end of a perfect day. Hesitantly, he asks, Do you ever wish you could always be like this? She nods, an almost imperceptible tilt of her head. Of course I do, but it can't be. Why not? He asks. Because it isn't. The universe doesn't work that way. She turns on her side away from him. He knows he is treading on thin ice now, but he can't leave it alone. I just wish... He begins, but she says, Jason, I can't always be your fantasy lover. The moment has become as fragile as a uranium atom. Jason pauses, his mind seething with the possibilities. Virtual particles come into being, annihilate, while he tries to decide. Should he fire a neutron into the nucleus, directly into the heart of the matter, increase its weight with questions until it splits apart, and in splitting yields its secrets? Or should he shield it, preserve its glittering presence for as long as possible? Jason feels the entire universe quiver with anticipation as he considers the ramifications. Weighs the options. decides. Oh, but you are, he says, kissing her earlobe and nestling up against her like one spoon behind another. He holds her, and as she drifts off to sleep, he thinks, you are my fantasy lover, and all the craziness, all the uncertainty is worth it for these moments when it's fantastic.